Tune in or listen to Absolutely Frivolous on our archives page on cfrc.ca.
St. Monday watches over you and me and grants the bone exhausted some liberty.
Greetings, loved ones. This is DJ Nasty Nexus coming to you live and direct from CFRC 101.9. I'm here to bring you the goods from my new show, Classless Radio, airing every Friday night at 11 p.m. I'll be giving you hits and hidden gems all the way from jazz to blues and hip-hop and R&B. Music from the soul that everybody needs. Hop on my wavelengths and get right with the kid to kick off your big weekend. Stay tuned.
Just to be a man.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, January 16th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering an upcoming screening at the Great Lakes Museum, the opening of Kingston's first queer bar in almost 20 years, an update from the Food Policy Council, some messages directly from the City of Kingston, and more. Without further delay, let's dive in. Friday, January 16th, the Great Lakes Museum is hosting a screening of the documentary Last Boat on the Lake, produced at Dalhousie University by Hannah Harrison. The film explores the lives of those who make their living on the Great Lakes, offering audiences a closer look at where their fish really comes from. Last Boat on the Lake follows the Great Lakes commercial fishing industry, one of the largest freshwater fisheries in the world. The documentary features Queen's researchers and fishing families just along the shoreline from Prince Edward County. The families featured in the film, along with the filmmakers, will be available for a Q&A following the screening. I spoke with visitor experience manager Claire Notman from the Great Lakes Museum about the event. Well, to start us off, why did the Great Lakes Museum choose Last Boat on the Lake to screen? What made this film stand out?
So this documentary is really interesting. So our mission is to connect people to the history and heritage of the Great Lakes, not just of the Kingston area, but the Great Lakes as a whole. And so this documentary is about the commercial fisheries that are on the Great Lakes. And I don't know about you, but I didn't know that before learning about this documentary. I didn't know that just up the shoreline in Prince Edward County, there is a commercial fishery that has been run by a family for generations. And that kind of goes all across the Great Lakes. There's these fisheries that are certainly getting smaller than they used to be, but that have been around for decades that very few of us know about.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there, this is happening just up the lake from us. I was wondering if you could dive a bit more into what makes this film relevant for Kingstonians and why we should be learning more about the Great Lakes commercial fisheries.
So I think this is an important film for Kingstonians and Canadians, because how often do you think about where your food comes from? We know, food, farm food is very kind of familiar to us. We know where those types of things come from. But the last time you ate like local fish, like a perch or a pickerel, that came from a local fishery just up the shoreline in Prince Edward County, most likely. And so I think we start to forget where our food comes from. And if we don't start to think about those things or how long those things have been kind of providing subsistence for not only us, but for Indigenous peoples for millennia, we're going to let them disappear. And I'm not sure that that's the best thing for the Great Lakes or the best thing for us as a community.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And you mentioned this topic was kind of new for you too before seeing the film. I was wondering what kinds of conversations you're hoping this event sparks for people in Kingston and other Great Lakes cities.
I hope this film kind of brings attention to the commercial fisheries on the Great Lakes, for one. They make up one of the world's largest freshwater commercial fisheries. Again, something I wasn't aware of, and I think most people aren't. I think it also highlights the health of the Great Lakes. These commercial fisheries are starting to shrink or disappear because of invasive species, like the zebra mussel. Because of environmental changes in the weather, as the weather gets more harsh, it's more difficult to fish, and that these fisheries are actually having a hard time encouraging younger generations to be part of this work because it's very hard work. It is unpredictable work, but it's really important work.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could also speak to how this relates to the mission of the Great Lakes Museum. We're always talking about, you know, the Keewatin and the ships and the museum itself, but I was wondering if you could speak a bit to how this film about commercial fisheries kind of relates to your guys' mission.
So our mission is to connect people to the history and heritage of the Great Lakes. And so this is an important part of Great Lakes heritage. It's really interesting that in the film, there was also a collaboration with the Saugeen Ojibwe Nation, which is located on the on Lake Huron, and they have their own independent fishery. And so not only are settler fisheries highlighted, but Indigenous histories are highlighted and fisheries are highlighted. And this was a collaboration between not just Dalhousie University, but Queen's University researchers are on this film. So it's a really great kind of local connection.
This isn't just a screening. You guys also have some special guests. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that opportunity.
Yeah, so we do have some special guests. We're very lucky. Hannah Harrison, who is an assistant professor and the filmmaker, she will be at the screening to answer questions. And we're also going to have four of the fishing families from Prince Edward County come and kind of talk about their life on the lake. What it's like to work at a commercial fishery, the struggles they're facing, and answer any questions people in the audience that might have.
Awesome. And what are you hoping audiences walk away with after this screening?
I hope people just walk away with an appreciation. Appreciation for how hard this work is, where our food comes from, and how important it is to protect the health of the lakes and those that live off the lakes.
Awesome. And how can folks attend and learn more?
So this is happening on Friday, January 16th, starting at 7. Doors open at 6:30. You can buy tickets on our website, greatlakesmuseum.ca, or tickets will be available at the door, and they are $20.
That was Visitor Experience Manager Claire Notman with the Great Lakes Museum, speaking about their upcoming screening of Last Boat on the Lake. The event takes place Friday, January 16th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Great Lakes Museum located at 55 Ontario Street. For more information and tickets, visit greatlakesmuseum.ca. For the first time since 2009, Kingston has a dedicated queer bar once again. Announced just after the new year, Bottoms Up officially opened its doors on Saturday, January 3rd, taking over the former University Tavern space in the basement of the Renaissance. I stopped by the bar this week to speak with owner Paul Fortier about this new endeavor.
What made you go, Kingston needs this and we're going to be the ones to do it?
I mean, Dennis, my partner and I, Dennis and I, we've been in Kingston since 1994. We operated the restaurants at Fort Henry, the public house downtown. We've been here at Renaissance for 20 years, including the backyard patio since the pandemic. And this was University Tavern. And we would have dance parties, you know, maybe not every weekend, but at least one dance party a week during the student session. But there's just so much competition for dance parties too, that we found that that crowd was, it was really hard to attract a crowd, even that this much further off of the beaten path from the hub. So we said, well, what can we do with this space? And that's going to be unique. That's going to have a niche market and be something that we're good at doing, because we've been hosting pride events or events for the LGBT community really since the 90s, at a time when other venues wouldn't do it because, you know, it was just too controversial, unfortunately, to even think that it should have been controversial. But there were places that wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole 20 years ago. And we were very happy to accommodate. Because, I mean, Dennis and I are both part of the gay community. And, you know, clearly. And we've been around. We've been to gay bars all of our lives. And have been in the food and beverage business for 40 years now. And we said, you know, let's take this space and to see. It's been since 2009, since Chez Fufu. I mean, this is well before your time, since Chez Fufu closed. And that was really the last dedicated sort of LGBTQ space that we had in the city. And it was sad to see that close. But, I mean, times change. You know, most clubs and bars, it's, you know, accept anyone. And the gay community is welcome anywhere these days where they weren't even 25, 30 years ago. But it's still nice to have a space that, you know, is dedicated to your community where you can really let your hair down and just be yourself. And we're happy to bring one back to Kingston after 20 years almost.
As Forte mentioned, while Kingston has long been home to LGBTQ plus events and inclusive venues, it hasn't had a specifically queer bar since Chez Fufu closed its doors 17 years ago. While rumors of replacements to fill the gap have come and gone over the years, Bottoms Up is the first to make it a reality. Despite only having a few days' notice, the community response was immediate, with around 120 attendees at opening night.
And you got a bit into your opening night there. How was that? And in general, how's the community response been since you opened this past weekend?
You know what? It's been really, really positive. And not just the allies and friends who I've known in the community for many, many years have sent words of, you know, good wishes, hoping that things go well. And it is, you know, it is somewhat controversial. It's a little bit controversial that even in today, in this day, which is unfortunate that that needs to be the case. But still, I said to myself, at this point in my life, I'm happy to bring something with this space at Renaissance and here, Bottoms Up in the lower salon, to bring it to the community and let's enjoy it. And I really, I'm encouraged at the response we had just with only a few days of advertising that we were opening. Really no one knew until after New Year's that this was planned. And for on the 3rd of January to have such a strong crowd show up was really, really encouraging.
I was wondering if you could paint a picture of that night a little bit and how it was for you guys.
Well, of course, no one knew what was going to happen. And it wasn't like it was a party by invitation. So we had, you know, a few people would say they're going to come by, but you never know. There was, you know, nothing firm. But right from 7 o'clock, people were coming through the door. And by 8:30, it was a great crowd. And by 10 o'clock, the place was full and people were wanting to dance. And we got the dancing started about 10:30, 10:45. So it was, I was surprised, to be honest. I didn't know what to expect. And the staff as well didn't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. And they were very pleased at the response.
Looking ahead, Fortier says he's optimistic that the momentum will continue, especially with students returning to Kingston after the holiday break and discovering the space for the first time.
Of course, we opened at a time when the students weren't here. You know, there were very few students in the city last weekend. But this weekend, you know, people are coming back, and the next couple of weekends, people are coming back and looking for different experiences, I think, too. And I've already had lots of communications with some young people from the university, from the colleges who are, you know, excited about coming and seeing what the space is all about.
The Wolf Islander 3 is back in service after weeks of disruption, but uncertainty around the future of ferry service remains. The disruption began December 22nd, when the Ministry of Transportation halted service on the Wolf Islander 4 due to what it described as a mechanical issue. In a statement at the time, the ministry said the ferry would be out of service while staff worked to resolve the problem. To keep the route running, the Quinte Loyalist and the Amherst Islander 2 were brought in to cover trips between the island and Kingston. The Amherst Islander 2 carried vehicles and passengers during the day, while the Quinte Loyalist handled walk-on passengers overnight. On Tuesday, January 6th, the ministry announced the Wolf Islander 3 had completed a dry dock inspection in Hamilton and had begun its return to Kingston. The following night, Wednesday, January 7th, the vessel officially returned to service, relieving both replacement ferries and restoring a 60-minute round-trip schedule between the Kingston and Marysville docks. For many island residents, the return of the Wolf Islander 3 was met with relief. On the Wolf Island Ferry Updates and Issues Facebook page, users welcomed back Old Faithful and expressed frustration with the reliability of the newer Wolf Islander 4. While service has stabilized for now, questions remain unanswered. The Ministry of Transportation has not provided a timeline for when the Wolf Islander 4 will return to service, or whether the two ferries will operate together once repairs are complete. In its most recent update, the ministry repeated only that staff will continue to work diligently to bring the Wolf Islander 4 back into service as soon as possible. The boats may be moving again, but the long-term plan still seems unclear. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today with CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Friday, January 16th, daytime high of minus 10, overnight low of minus 12. Moving into the weekend, Saturday, January 17th, high of 0. And it'll actually feel a degree warmer than that, a real temperature feel of 1 degree, dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Sunday, January 18th, daytime high of minus 3, overnight low of minus 14. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, January 19th, daytime high of minus 4. But folks, it's going to be cold, wind chill making it feel closer to minus 15 with a 60% chance of light snow. This week's City of Kingston traffic report has very little to report, but I do want to remind our listeners that the full winter parking restrictions went into effect on January 1st. During January and February, overnight on-street parking is not permitted, no matter the weather conditions. That will change in March, where overnight on-street parking will be banned only if the weather and conditions require it, so think particularly snowy or icy evenings. When restrictions are in place, parking on city streets is prohibited from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m. On the streets surrounding Kingston General Hospital, the ban runs from 12 a.m. to 7 a.m. Vehicles left on the street during bans are subject to ticketing and towing. To learn more about parking restrictions, how they work, and to stay informed, you can visit the City of Kingston website.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. The Food Policy Council for KFLNA is continuing its work towards a comprehensive regional food strategy, launching a series of 5 targeted focus groups over the coming weeks. In collaboration with Queen's University and other community partners, the council is embarking on consultations designed to better understand what communities across Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington need in order to build a sustainable and equitable local food system. These consultations will take a deeper dive into 5 key areas: rural food production, urban food production, food security, food retail and distribution, and food education and literacy. The first consultation, focused on rural food production, including farmers and market gardeners, took place on Monday. Members of the Food Policy Council, co-chair Ellen Mortfield and Queen's University School of Environmental Studies assistant professor Kristen Lowett sat down to discuss the launch of the consultation process and what it aims to achieve. Mortfield explained what's led the council to this stage in its work.
It's been quite a few years building to this point. Last year, working with Kristen and Queen's University, the Food Policy Council did secure a bit of funding to launch us on this process of starting a food strategy for Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington. So we've been slowly building. We had some more casual potluck events over the summer just to get the conversation started. And now we're conducting these targeted focus groups with specific sectors within the food system. So last night was our first one with the rural food production folks. We had a good turnout. I think there's about 20, wasn't there, Kristen?
Yeah, I think probably, what, 14, 15 producers?
Yeah, yeah, and really interesting conversations, lots of ideas. We started to work towards prioritizing some of those ideas, some action items that we'll be able to pursue. And all of these sort of ideas and goals and objectives and action plans will be set out in the finished food strategy. But at this stage, we're just trying to make note of these ideas, get people connected so we can start pursuing some of these action items, and really make some significant improvements over the next few years in people's access to local food in this area. That's the big goal.
Following several informal meetings over the summer and now one completed consultation, Lowitt says the council is already beginning to identify key themes emerging from the discussions. Among them, the importance of connection across different sectors of the food system and the notion of building food sovereignty in the region.
We did begin, I'll step back for a second, right, in terms of slightly bigger context. So the Food Policy Council has been around since just over 10 years, since around 2013. And I think its mandate when it started was to, you know, contribute to the community food system in this region. And I think over the summer and the informal potluck series you're referring to, and then, you know, the first session we're having now, I think one of the biggest takeaways, at least for myself personally, is just like the importance of these sorts of forums or events for convening and gathering people in food systems that may not always have a chance to connect or speak to one another. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, people are busy, but there's also, you know, a lot of fragmentation, you know, between, you know, farmers or policymakers or people that are eating food or even teachers that might be teaching or whatever, right? So often there isn't really a way for a lot of these different actors to connect. And so I think that's been really powerful just in terms of sharing ideas. With the farmers and food producers last night, for example, you know, it became clear pretty quickly. There were some shared, issues, concerns sort of in common, right? We had an extended kind of conversation about, you know, distribution and how do we scale up distribution of regional foods, right? And some common challenges experienced with respect to, building a bigger pool of customers and, you know, distributing more widely, right? So I think there's a really big need for these sort of convening, and that's kind of really what the Food Policy Council was meant to do, right? Because too often, food is really sort of the food system is often really kind of fragmented in terms of policy. You know, like health has a piece over here, and then maybe agriculture somewhere else, and often, you know, it's under economic development or whatever. There often isn't a more integrated forum for discussing some of these issues and bringing them together and connecting some of the pieces. And so this summer was really valuable for that because we had folks from across the food system to coming together. The focus groups similarly, although we're focusing a little bit deeper now on kind of, you know, specific sort of aspects or questions and kind of groups in the food system. So I think that to me is one of the big takeaways and one of the big values. And, the second would be, I think, related to that is hopefully, this notion of sort of building food sovereignty, right? And in the kind of the larger food system, there's such a lack of control for farmers or fishers or eaters, right? Often in terms of, you know, where's the food coming from, who's growing it, who has control of inputs or seed supplies, farmers being more, price takers and these sorts of things, right? And being squeezed in different ways in value chains and just corporations and governments that are often, you know, complicit with what they want, really not responding to the need of, you know, communities, of localities, of regional, more ecological food production, I want to call it that. So I think, that need to convene and hopefully feel like, I think the local and the regional scales are really powerful in terms of building some of those connections, discussing shared issues and thinking about, you know, what can we do here? What are the assets and values we have here that allow us to build the food system in a more kind of food sovereign, food system that the community, you know, kind of collectively wants.
As mentioned, the council has already gained insight into some of the key challenges and has begun brainstorming potential solutions based on feedback from participants in the first session.
we'll see the commonalities, I think, once we get more of the groups going. But in this first one, I think it was interesting to see some of the ideas that came out. Just people, you know, with this shared experience of in local food production. Some of the things that were talked about is like a food hub or a food cooperative. Is that something that would be helpful to our farmers? Also, some of the issues, like one of our biggest problems here is not enough food being produced locally. Farmers are kind of aging out of the system and they're not being replaced by young people coming into farming. So that's an issue there. And then other things like difficulties with local bylaws and the differences in enforcement and bylaws, even in between the counties, like Lennox and Addington and Frontenac counties, have different ways of dealing with growth in food production and farm businesses. And so those are the sorts of difficulties that the folks that came out to participate last night, those are the kinds of things that they were talking about.
Looking ahead, Mortfield and Lowitz say the next steps will be analyzing the information gathered and beginning to develop concrete action items once the sessions wrap up in early February.
Our hope is that we can kind of prioritize some of these ideas and actions on, you know, the quick wins, the ones that are going to take a few years of work. And we need to identify who needs to be involved to move these forward. And there's lots of work to be done, but setting some goals, you know, having a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, and people at the table that are willing to tackle some of these, that's what we want to achieve out of these sessions.
Yeah, I mean, some of these, you know, the discussions and these focus groups have started to, you know, I've done kind of some of the larger sort of visioning exercises, and now we're really starting to focus on, you know, some of the concrete and tangible actions that communities, organizations, citizens in the food system can take and would like to see. So we've started to do some of that kind of actioning and prioritizing. And I think there's a lot of really, you know, concrete kind of proposals that came up even just in the session last night, right? Like, for example, is there potential to establish a food hub? We spent some time talking about, you know, a cooperative grocery store. There's another really tangible example. We had a representative from CASI, the Kingston Area Seed Saving Initiative, in attendance, who, you know, really was encouraging members of the community to grow out some of their local and traditional seeds, right? That's a really tangible action, right, that gardeners or school gardeners or farmers can take up, right? So I think we have some really kind of tangible examples, and there's, you know, it's fantastic for our council too, because I think this is the start of a process, right? It's sort of a food strategy, so then we can also identify, you know, some of these, you know, short, medium term, maybe longer term sort of policy actions or initiatives that we want to kind of collectively sort of work on or continue to convene, right, with these other groups in the food system and try to move ahead, right, coming out of this food strategy process.
Several consultations are still on the horizon. The Urban Food Production Consultation, focused on community gardeners, urban agriculture, and food forests, takes place Monday, January 19th from 5 to 8 p.m. The Food Security Consultation, centered on charitable and emergency food access, will follow on Monday, January 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. Food retail and distribution, including restaurants and local food outlets and markets, will be the focus on Monday, February 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. The final consultation on food education and literacy involving school boards, public health, and educators takes place Monday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. Community researcher Ayla Fenton is coordinating all 5 sessions. Those interested in participating in a consultation relevant to their work are encouraged to contact her at aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. That's aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. The City of Kingston has officially received an entry-level bird-friendly city certification from Nature Canada. To obtain a bird-friendly city status, a municipality must earn points across 3 categories: threat reduction, habitat protection, restoration and climate resilience, and community reach and education. Certification is awarded on one of 3 levels: entry, intermediate, or high. The city established a bird team about a year ago to work towards making Kingston more bird safe. Notably, the city held a public poll to name an official bird this past fall, a lively race which ended in a tie between the cardinal and the crow. According to the city, Kingston's application received strong marks, bordering on the intermediate level. Karen Santucci, Director of Public Works and Solid Waste with the city, sat down with CFRC to share more about the city's bird-friendly status. I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit about the city's bird team and the work that's gone into this to get us here.
Yeah, so the city started working on their bird-friendly certification about a year ago. We have a bird-friendly team, which is a very, we've got some very active people on the team. The team consists of some community groups like Little Forests, Master Gardeners, Kingston Field Naturalists, Sustainable Kingston. It includes people from Queens and St. Lawrence. It includes some representation from some different Indigenous groups. So it's a very active team. And we worked together to pull together an application. And the application really looked at a number of different things. It looked at threat reduction. It looked at how to conserve and restore and create bird habitats. And it looked at how do we engage the public. So the city worked on that, but the team also worked together. So the team came together. They did three World Migratory Bird Days this year. One of the groups had got a grant to run one of those Migratory World Bird Days where they did a hedge seminar. So they taught people how to plant hedges, which were great for birds populations as well. So lots of stuff has gone into it. Our application went in. We were certified at the entry level, but we were like 1 point short of intermediate level. So our bird team is working really hard right now to make sure we can gain that point and move us up to an intermediate level for next year.
Awesome. And you just mentioned there, bird team has no plans of stopping. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what's in the works and maybe what we're going to see in 2026.
Yeah, so 2026, we actually have a meeting coming up in February to talk about what our goals are going to be for that for next year. I think what you will probably see is some stuff on light pollution that we'll be working on, some stuff on bird window collisions that we'll be working on, and possibly some stuff on roaming cats. There's a lot that's also happening with the city. So right now the city is working on their official plan. We're working on our natural heritage study. We're working our forestry management strategy. Out of that will also come our tree bylaw. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's happening at the city that will go into that conserve, restore, create bird habitat sections of the report. And hopefully we'll see some changes in that in the next year as well.
Awesome. And what can residents do to contribute and keep up with all these developments?
We have a new bird-friendly page on the city's website, which talks about all these different areas and gives residents some ideas of things that they could do to help support birds as well. So we encourage people to take a look at that. Other things they can do is just, you know, making sure they're creating habitat for trees, not letting cats roam. If they're leaving out food, understanding where that best is to go and what quality of food people should be putting out. Lots of things they can do, lots of ideas on our website. Lots of work also with Little Forests, Master Gardeners, Kingston Field Naturalists. They're always working on things to do with birds, plants. So anyone who's looking to be involved, that's an excellent avenue as well to join in with the community and work on some of these activities with us.
Once again, that was Karen Santucci, Director of Public Works and Solid Waste with the City of Kingston. As Santucci said, the city and their bird team look forward to setting new goals and advancing Kingston's status as a bird-friendly city next year. Learn more about the city's bird-friendly city activities and how to make your home a bird-friendly space at cityofkingston.ca/bird-friendly. In a message directly from the City of Kingston, beginning January 14th, the Market Wing Cultural Space at Kingston City Hall will host A History Exposed, The Enslavement of Black People in Canada, a traveling exhibition created by the Canadian Museum of Immigration at Pier 21, in partnership with Dr. Afua Cooper and the Black Cultural Centre for Nova Scotia. The exhibition will remain on view until May 22, 2026. For many, Canada's connection to slavery is understood primarily through the Underground Railroad. A History Exposed brings to light a lesser-known history, the over two centuries when Black people were enslaved in the territories that would become Canada. Through individual biographies, archival records, and historical context, the exhibition explores who the enslaved people were, who enslaved them, and how this legacy continues to shape our country today.
Presented across seven double-sided panels, the exhibition offers a space for visitors to confront Canada's history of enslavement and reflect on its ongoing social and cultural impacts. City Curator Melissa Cruz states, quote, "Hosting this exhibition is an important opportunity for our community to engage with a truth that has long been overlooked in Canadian history. By acknowledging the realities of enslavement in Canada, we take a meaningful step toward understanding the roots of anti-Black racism and creating a more inclusive and informed society." A History Exposed was developed with guest curator Dr. Afua Cooper, one of Canada's foremost scholars of Black history and enslavement, whose research and writing, including her landmark book, The Hanging of Angelique, have shaped national conversations about race, history, and justice. Dr. Cooper emphasizes that recognizing the history of slavery in Canada is essential to understanding the full story of the nation's development and to honoring the lives of those who endured enslavement. Again, the exhibit is on view January 14th to May 22nd, 2026 in the Market Wing Cultural Space at City Hall, 216 Ontario Street. Hours are Tuesday to Friday, 12 p.m. to 4 p.m., and admission is free. Once again, that was a message directly from the City of Kingston on a new exhibit at City Hall. In another message directly from the city, Big Ideas Wanted, applications open for the 2026 Mayor's Innovation Challenge. Big ideas start here. If you know a post-secondary student with a passion for making Kingston better, encourage them to apply for the 2026 Mayor's Innovation Challenge. Offered in partnership with Queen's University, St. Lawrence College, and the Royal Military College, the Mayor's Innovation Challenge invites current and recently graduated students to turn bold ideas into real-world solutions that strengthen our community and shape the future of Kingston. The winning teams will have an opportunity to gain valuable experience through the Summer Company Program and a $10,000 prize sponsored by Bell to advance their idea, or a chance to turn their idea into a business venture with admission to the Queen's Founders and Innovators Initiative, and the opportunity to unlock up to $4,000 in seed funding, along with a chance to compete in their pitch competition with a prize pool of up to $80,000. Mayor Brian Patterson says, quote, "I'm proud to kick off 2026 by opening applications for the 9th edition of the Mayor's Innovation Challenge. Year after year, this initiative highlights the creativity and drive of Kingston's post-secondary students. I'm looking forward to seeing how this new group of innovators brings forward bold ideas, addresses local priorities, and helps shape an even stronger future for our city," end quote. Students are asked to submit a 2 to 3 minute video outlining an innovative project that improves quality of life for Kingston residents or introduces new approaches to delivering municipal services. Teams with proposals that are shortlisted will be invited to present their ideas at the pitch competition on March 20th. The competition will be at City Hall to a panel of leaders with expertise in municipal government entrepreneurship and innovation. Some key dates: interested participants can register for the following workshop. Tuesday, February 10th, 4 to 5:30 p.m. at Mitchell Hall Event Commons, 69 Union Street. You can also join online, registering on Zoom. Friday, March 6th, deadline for proposals at 11:59 p.m. Monday, March 9th, shortlisted teams are invited to the pitch competition. And Friday, March 20th, student pitch competition at City Hall. Don't miss your chance to help shape the future of Kingston. Apply now and turn your bright idea into reality. Learn more about the Mayor's Innovation Challenge on Get Involved Kingston or by emailing mic@cityofkingston.ca. Once again, that was another message directly from the City of Kingston on this year's Mayor's Innovation Challenge. One more message directly from the city this evening: downtown event parking is closer than you think. Planning to head downtown to cheer on the Kingston Frontenacs, to enjoy a concert at Slush Puppy Place or show at the Grand Theater, or to check out Springer Market Square? There are plenty of affordable municipal parking options within a short walk. Recent parking studies show that municipal parking garages and nearby lots regularly have space available during events. Surface lots, on-street parking, and transit add to the mix, giving people more ways to get downtown depending on their plans. The city's new downtown events parking page is now live, giving people a clearer picture of where to park and how close those spots really are to event venues. The page brings event parking details together in one place, including an interactive map showing approximate walking times from nearby parking lots and garages to Slush Puppy Place, Springer Market Square, and the Grand Theater, a link to parking lot and garage details including each site's maximum capacity, affordable flat evening and event parking rates by location, a live camera feed on available spots at the Hanson and Chown parking garages, transit and park ride options — active transportation is a great way to skip the parking spot search —
on-street parking, and honk payment information. Know before you go. Visit cityofkingston.ca/eventparking for more information. Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. On Friday, January 16th, we have trivia at Wild Wings Kingston at 7, a 90s party at Something in the Water at 7, and late-night sing-alongs with country karaoke at The Buckle and karaoke at Daft Brewing, both starting at 9. On Saturday, January 17th, the Kingston Public Market runs from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Later in the evening, we have some burlesque with capital T's at the Broom Factory starting at 8. On Sunday, January 18th, start your day at the Memorial Center Farmers Market from 9 to 1. And you can end the weekend with trivia at the Merchant at 8 and late-night karaoke at the Toucan at 10:30. That wraps up your upcoming events. Now let's dive into some concerts coming up this week. Friday, January 16th is packed with live music all over town. It gets going with Christopher Jackson at the Toucan at 5 p.m., Wildcard at Timeout at 6, and the Jack DeCaser Band at the Coven at 7. Also at 7, Lucanus Pell plays Lakeside Bar and Grill. Later in the evening, catch Mike Guinea and friends at Hotel Wolf Island at 8, Mellow Lily at Tiernanog at 9, and late night shows from Squid Pistol at Royal Tavern 2.0, the Oreos at the Merchant, and Overrated at the Toucan, all starting around 10:30 p.m. Saturday, January 17th might be the busiest night of the week. There's Jack DeCaser Band back at the Coven, plus Gerald McGrath at the Embassy, David Shooter at the Social YGK, Maduro Lads at Time Out, and Henry Taylor with Monique Montgomery at Hotel Wolf Island, all starting at 7 p.m. At 7:30, Mellow's Chantuary performs at St. John the Apostle. Later on, the Rugrats album release party and guitar battle at the Mansion at 8, Neil Carter at Tiernanog at 9, and China Cat Riders at the Toucan at 10:30. And on Sunday, January 18th, closing out the week, the afternoon includes Soulfire at the Coven and Chris Kaguire at McKinnon Brothers Brewery, both at 1 p.m. At 2:30, Tom Allen and friends present J.S. Batch's Long Walk in the Snow at the Isabel. The evening wraps up with Eric and Megan at the Coven at 5 and open mic with Steve G plus Derek Meredith at Timeout starting at 7 p.m. Once again, that was just some of the events and concerts coming up this weekend in the region. Be sure to head to CFRC.ca for our full events and concerts listings. If you have an event or concert you'd like to add to our online and on-air calendar, reach out today via CFRC.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Quaymo! Quaymo, my goodness! Nico Quaymo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.